Hi, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA. We all love great stories. And great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you every week. Latino USA presents a mix of reporting on culture and politics, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues, featuring stories that will make you think and maybe even inspire you. Listen to Latino USA on your favorite podcast app from PRX.
A big U.S. military aid package for Ukraine still held up in Congress. This Ukrainian Army corporal says troops on the front lines are dangerously low on ammunition.
Well, it's been a pretty tough year, frankly speaking.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, immigration courts here in the U.S. are overwhelmed and struggling to keep up with the number of asylum cases.
Our staff is working nonstop until late hours of the night.
New courts and judges could provide some relief.
And voices from Yemen, a country that's been through almost a decade of war.
Yemeni people have so much persistence and resilience, and this is what is surprising.
We'll also hear about new technology for flying cars.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. The Navy in Ukraine says it's been able to sink or disable about a third of all Russian warships in the Black Sea. A military spokesman said the latest successful strikes came on Saturday night, with three Russian ships all damaged by a Ukrainian missile strike.
Not all of the war news has been good for Ukraine, though. Over the past 2 years, we've been periodically checking in with Andrei Shadrin. He's a 28-year-old corporal in the Ukrainian military who works with a unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged in frontline fighting. These days, Shadrin is deployed outside the town of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. When we spoke earlier today, I asked him how the situation had changed in that area around Bakhmut in the past year.
Well, we've got some minor retreatments, most of them because of the lack of artillery shells. It's like a nonstop Verdun.
Verdun was the longest battle of the First World War.
Yeah, like absolutely nonstop assaults. You can fight for months for one field.
Wow. So it's relentless.
Yeah. Like you spend dozens of people for control over like 4 square kilometers. That's all.
So the cost of each inch is measured in fallen colleagues.
From both sides.
Well, so the resolve is there, but how are the soldiers feeling?
Well, it's a hard job to do. You've got no chance to flee. So that's your job. You're a soldier. Your country is at war.
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Can you tell me more about the changes in the battlefield that you've seen in the past year in terms of how much ammunition and equipment is available to soldiers?
We're pretty short on, especially artillery shells and aviation. You have to always keep in mind that your artillery that is covering you, that you're in touch with, they're shot on shells and might not come to save the day.
And how have you seen that personally? How has that lack of military aid impacted you?
Oh, well, we've been shelled by 2 tanks for 3 hours in a row. We've asked our drones to find the tank. They did it. But the artillery that we were in touch with said that we're awfully sorry. Your call is definitely important for us, but we've got no rounds to help the supply unit. All the shells are for the infantry.
So a drone identified where the firing was coming from. The tank could have been taken out, but there was just no ammunition to do so.
It's not like there was no ammunition in the area, but all the ammunition was for the infantry. Maybe one out of 3 calls will be responded in the right way.
Wow. So you were directly under fire at that time?
It was an urban area. We were in a basement. Nothing bad happened, but that's more because of we were lucky enough to get shelled in the urban area. Because like if we were in the field, I think that we would have some casualties. And we've lost a vehicle.
It says a lot that you phrase it as lucky enough to get shelled in an urban area.
Yeah, that's like, that's a lucky day when you're shelled in an urban area.
So how does that feel to be kind of a sitting duck there?
Oh, it's like when you're on foot, when you're in a light vehicle, maybe something like a pickup truck or a Humvee, you're like always a sitting duck. Like you're used to it.
So given that, I'm curious about how attitudes about the U.S. have changed among Ukrainian soldiers in the past year. I remember when I was reporting there in June, there was a lot of gratitude for the supplies that the U.S. was sending over. What are feelings now?
That was a great amount of help. With no doubts, the Western equipment, it's better than the Soviet one. But the point is, with all the capabilities, with all the amount of defense budget of United States of America, we now rely on supplies from Czech Republic. And we've managed to, like, you know, take a breath and hush Russians a little bit.
I want to ask about your injury. Since we last talked, last spring you were injured evacuating a Humvee from Bakhmut. You came under Russian fire and got shrapnel in your knee. You had surgery, and after about 3 months of recuperation, you redeployed. How was it getting back to the battlefield after all that?
That's my job. It has to be done. I'm capable of doing it. I'm experienced. I'm a professional, and my people need me. So that was something like coming back to an office, but a like really shitty office.
Yeah, I know you've been struck by shrapnel before. This was more serious.
Yeah, but I've got a shrapnel in the head in 2014 when I was 18. And that was like nothing that serious. It just scratched my skin a little bit. This time, yeah, got some... like some bones damaged and like damaged some parts of my knee. I can walk, but like it still like brings me some discomfort and some pain.
How common is it for Ukrainian soldiers to get injured and then return to fighting like you've done? Has that happened to many of the soldiers in your unit?
Almost everyone.
There are people who are saying these days that this war will ultimately end in a compromise with Russia. There's no other way. So Ukraine should agree now to sacrifice some territory in the interest of bringing an end to the violence and saving lives. What do you say to that?
As part of an army, I cannot, you know, take any decisions. If the world decides to let Russians away with what they've done, like we've already done it in Munich, 1938. That's how World War II started.
That's when there was an agreement that allowed Germany to annex part of Czechoslovakia in exchange for peace from Hitler, which of course did not happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're having war today, or we're having war in like 5, 10, 15 years.
I have to say, Corporal Chaudhrin, you sound tired.
I am.
Is that just a constant state these days?
In the very beginning, for the first year, maybe till I was shot, it's like something new happened. You got some experience, you got some emotions. Now it is just a routine. Like even being shelled is a routine.
Corporal Andriy Chaudhrin serves in a Ukrainian military unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged on the war's front lines. He spoke with us from eastern Ukraine. Thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with us.
Doing my best. Thank you.
There is a massive backup in immigration courts across the U.S., nearly 3 million asylum cases pending. To deal with the backlog, the Biden administration recently added 6 courts and some 300 judges to the system. One of the newest immigration courts is in the San Francisco Bay Area. As KQED senior immigration editor Taiki Hendricks found, these new courtrooms may help, but they also create some new challenges.
At an immigration forum in a high school gymnasium in Concord, California, east of San Francisco, A couple hundred people browse information tables or wait in folding chairs for free consultations with immigration lawyers.
Porque si no han oído, ya abrieron una corte de migración aquí en Concord.
You're hearing Eliodoro Moreno over the loudspeaker. He's a lawyer with the Contra Costa County Public Defender's Office, and he says cases are moving to the new court here in Concord, and people need to check for a new time and place of their hearing, because if they don't show, they can be ordered deported. More than 40,000 cases have already been transferred from the San Francisco Immigration Court, one of the most backlogged in the nation.
There is an immense shortage.
Ali Saidi runs the county's small team of immigration lawyers, but they can't serve everyone. So he helped organize this event to offer mini consultations to as many people as possible.
And so what we're doing here is we're trying to bundle all of the nonprofit services that do exist in the county to come to the community where folks feel safe so that they can get accurate information about how to proceed given the lack of resources.
When it's fully staffed up, the Concord Court will have 21 judges, almost doubling the capacity in the Bay Area. Mimi Tsankov is president of the National Immigration Judges Union. She says that's welcome because the San Francisco court handles the bulk of cases from Bakersfield, deep in California's Central Valley, all the way up to the Oregon border.
Clearly, there's a huge need based on the large geographic spread that has been serviced by San Francisco.
Nationally, the Biden administration has tried to beef up capacity, adding 6 new immigration courts and more than 300 judges. But Tsankov says to do their job, judges also need better computer systems and more language interpreters and law clerks.
Our staff is working nonstop until late hours of the night.
Court officials say all support needs are covered at the Concord facility. But even with the expansion in judges and staff, as more people apply for asylum at the border, the courts can't keep up. This year, the Biden administration asked for another increase for more immigration courts as part of a recent budget bill. But House Republicans wound up cutting funding instead. Doris Meisner is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. She says staffing up the immigration courts is critical for the whole U.S. immigration system to work.
A functional immigration judge system is essential today in order for there to be effective border control that also allows for fairness and timeliness for the people that are seeking protection.
But people in immigration proceedings don't have the right to a court-appointed lawyer the way criminal defendants do. And nationwide, fewer than a third of immigrants facing deportation have lawyers. The opening of the new Concord Court may lead to more timely hearings, but Ali Saidi, who runs the county deportation defense program here, worries with cases moving faster, people may have less time to find the legal help they need.
Being kind of pipelined into a rushed deportation process without access to attorneys, that to me is a serious due process problem.
Without a lawyer, more than 80% of asylum seekers lose their cases. With a lawyer, nearly half win. Saidi says there are 13,000 immigration cases in his county alone, and he has just a half a dozen attorneys.
Obviously, 6 lawyers is not enough to handle all of that. That's why we're not doing this alone.
So Saidi is teaming up with local immigrant rights groups to host legal clinics like this one in the high school gym. Rosaura Mayen brought her husband to the event. Mayen says she came to the U.S. from Guatemala 7 years ago, fleeing threats from a gang that was going after her teenage daughter. An advocate connected her with a nonprofit attorney, and last September, she and her daughter won asylum. Now she's here hoping to find legal help for her husband as well. For The World, I'm Taiki Hendricks, Concord, California.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yemen, the nation that sits on the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula, has been at war for nearly a decade. The thumbnail backgrounder, a rebel group known as the Houthis, rose up in 2014. Today, they control much of the country. Yemen's deposed president called on neighboring Saudi Arabia to restore him to power. That has not happened despite years of airstrikes, closures of seaports and airports, and a crippling economic embargo. One Yemeni woman living in exile reached out to people across Yemen and in the diaspora to ask a simple question: how has the war impacted your life? Nuha Al-Junaid is the creator and curator of the Yemen Listening Project. Nuha, thanks for coming on to take us through this project. What is the headline here? What has become of Yemen after 9 years without peace?
Well, now seeing that Yemen has entered the 10th year of conflict, and there is little room left for the average Yemeni to express their opinions and talk about their needs, and they feel that they're not being heard. You know that tens of millions more have been caught up in Yemen's conflict, but the story was told by journalists, aid groups, and politicians most of the time. So this is the main reason that I have came up with this project, and drives me to listen to normally many people.
Yeah, so let's get into that. We wanted to hear a few voices from the 100 or so you collected, the sit-down oral histories. I mean, these are real-time accounts. Let's hear from one now.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Ya'qub al-Muntasir. I'm 29 years old. I'm an American of Yemeni descent. I currently reside in New York City. So this is how the civil war in Yemen affected me. Back in 2017, I got married to my beloved wife. Back then, there was a land, air, and sea blockade on Yemen. Unfortunately, it made it extremely hard.
Wow, personal event, a marriage deferred by this war. Nuha, tell us more about Ya'qub al-Muntasir.
So yes, Ya'qub is one of the stories that really impressed me, because Ya'qub has suffered from not being connected to his family member. His wife was having her first child, and he had to leave the United States and come back to Yemen in order to stay with her, and waited for about 3 years to be reunited with her.
Yeah, well, 3 years apart.
Yes, from 2019 until 2022, until he gets his reunion papers done and got his wife from Yemen to the States.
Well, not surprisingly, different parts of Yemen have experienced the war differently. You got this voice message from a woman in the city of Taiz in Yemen.
My name is Fatima, and I am in Taiz.
5 years ago, my 13-year-old daughter was shot as she was leaving school. She had injuries in her mouth and shrapnel in her brain and chest.
And the follow-up there is the daughter was taken to Cairo for surgery, but she and her mom are back now in Taiz. Nuha, tell us about conditions in Taiz. What are they going back to?
So most of the stories in Taiz are mostly talking about snipers, road blockage. I still remember well Fatma Al-Effendi, who is now 13 years old, but was shot when she was really younger age. And I saw her, I remember seeing her on TV.
Yeah.
She's still, until now, mentally affected because of what happened to her. She has fear in her heart. She can't handle loud noises, sounds of gunfires, explosions. She's full of panic. So the war took away the sense of safety from people, and anxiety and fear prevail in most of the families.
What is the prognosis for the diminution of that anxiety and fear? Essentially, the end of the war?
But we'd hope for that, of course.
And if that doesn't happen, I mean, just clinically, is there hope for the daughter getting better?
Well, despite of all of this, this daughter has returned to school. Yemeni people are living their life. They have so much persistence and resilience, and this is what is surprising. So they're still doing their day-to-day life. Like, this girl refuses to give up. She came back to school, she is living her normal life, but of course not being normal 100%. We all know the effect of mental health among children and also her parents as well.
Yeah, I'm very glad to hear she wants to go to school. I'm curious, Nuha, how did you connect with the Yemeni people? They're spread far and wide. How did they know the Yemen Listening Project wanted to hear from them?
So basically, before I started this project, I drew a strategy how to access and get the trust of Yemeni people. I'm so honored that people trusted me and shared their stories as well.
Yeah.
Like, one of the strategies that we worked on was dedicating a WhatsApp number that people can reach out to us through.
I chose WhatsApp and Facebook because most of the Yemenis are connecting through these two tools. Mm. They can access directly to me. I speak Arabic and I'm one of them. I'm a Yemeni person. So this is very important when approaching Yemenis, someone like them, someone without a political background, connected to a party or another, a neutral person who is not biased and just one of them.
As the Yemen Listening Project knows too well, these human personal stories often get eclipsed by the daily headlines about bombings and missile strikes, numbers of dead and casualty counts. What is your hope, Nuha, or plan to get these stories heard by policymakers, people who can presumably make a difference?
I believe that any effort, even if it's a little one, can make a great impact. Policymakers will sooner or later have to listen to these voices and make a peace agreement. It is not yet clear in Yemen how the things will be going on, but yeah, we cannot just stay silent.
So Nuha, let me put you on the spot and give you the question that you gave all the Yemenis that you spoke to for this project. For you, now living outside Yemen, how has the 9 years of war affected your life?
Well, that's a really sad question for me.
I'm sorry if it's raising up bad memories.
Yeah, it's okay. It is a bittersweet journey. I'm still attached to Yemen. War has changed my life in a way that it took me apart from my family, beloved ones, my country. Mm. I'm living in the Netherlands now, and I still feel the survival guilt. And I'm also reading these stories and working on this project. It was like deja vu, living the same feelings again. Mm. It is not an easy thing to be Yemeni outside Yemen, knowing that the war is eating your country. And also, it is not easy living inside Yemen. So both is hard. I've experienced both, and this is what I can do now. I'm sorry that I can't do much more.
Nuha Al-Junaid is the creator and curator of the Yemen Listening Project, an oral history project from the New Humanitarian. Nuha, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for hearing Yemeni's voices. I just want the world to hear that Yemen is not just a war or a humanitarian aid needed country. No, it is just a great country which needs really attention and not to be forgotten.
You're listening to The World.
Tens of millions of people in India are part of a religious tradition called Sarnaism. Hindu leaders see it as another form of their faith. Experts say that's not the case.
They believe in magic, they believe in spells, and they have their whole lot of structure around their religion, which makes it completely distinct.
A minority faith looking for recognition ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The recent attack on a concert hall in Moscow was a shock to many Russians. Authorities say 139 people were killed by members of an offshoot of the Islamic State group called ISIS-K. But in the days leading up to the attack, the United States warned the Kremlin that it was aware of an imminent threat to the Russian capital. It appears that those warnings were ignored. This was not the first time the U.S. shared intelligence with a nation that it considers an adversary. The World's Shirin Jafari has more detail on this. Shirin, why did the U.S. share sensitive intelligence information with Russia in the first place?
This is part of a policy called Duty to Warn. It was put into place in 2015 by James Clapper. He was the director of national intelligence at the time. And basically what it says is that if the U.S. has credible, reliable intelligence about a threat of physical harm or an attempt of murder against an individual or a group of people, then the intelligence community in the U.S. has a duty to warn that person or the government of that country. There are some exceptions, like, for example, if the person or the people that are being threatened are themselves terrorists. But in the case of Russia, the U.S. shared that intel with the Kremlin before the attack, like you said. Here's White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre speaking to the media earlier this week.
When we have information about imminent threat to civilian populations, we provide that information to the respective authorities. And that's what we did.
Jean-Pierre said that in early March, the U.S. shared that information with Moscow. It also issued a public advisory to Americans in Russia. It told them to stay away from large gatherings and concert venues because of a potential terrorist attack.
So obviously that attack did go ahead as planned. So Russia either ignored the warning or wasn't able to act on it in time. Do we know exactly what happened?
Well, governments get intelligence tips and warnings all the time, and whether they take them seriously or not depends on a couple of factors. One is who is sharing that intelligence. In this case, Russian President Vladimir Putin publicly dismissed the U.S.'s warnings, calling them provocative and outright blackmail, and he said that this was just to intimidate and destabilize Russian society. And Russia isn't alone here. In recent months, there have been other countries that have dismissed warnings from the U.S., at least from what we know publicly. In January, U.S. officials said that they had warned Iran, another U.S. adversary, and that there was going to be an attack by the same group, by the way, Caroline, the group that carried out the attack in Russia, ISIS-K. But it seems like the Iranian officials also either dismissed or didn't act upon the warnings, and that led to twin suicide bombings that killed 95 people. What this really comes down to is trust. And this is what Courtney Weinbaum told me. She's with the RAND Corporation.
Especially when you talk about adversarial nations, there's always going to be a motivation not to trust each other. There's always going to be this thinking that this is an information operation against us. They're trying to deceive us. They're trying to convince us to look the other way because there's something else that's really going on.
And as we know, Caroline, not acting and not taking threats seriously can turn out to be very costly.
Yeah. So, Sharin, how does this actually work? How does the U.S. get this intelligence information to governments like Russia or even, say, Iran, a country that the U.S. doesn't have diplomatic relations with?
You know, I had the same question and I asked Courtney Weinbaum about this. This is what she told me.
It could be, you know, a secretary of state calling up their counterpart, the foreign minister. It could be an intelligence officer going to the head of the other intelligence element. It could be the ambassador in the U.S. is called in to a meeting in the U.S. government. You know, there's plenty of options available to the U.S. government on how to share a message like that.
And, you know, she said that in the case of a country like Iran, where those avenues don't exist, there usually is a third nation that acts as the go-between between that country and the U.S., and that's how the U.S. delivers that message.
So do other countries have this same duty to warn policy that the U.S. has?
This is not a written policy on a global scale, like the Geneva Convention, for example. But it is also not unique to the U.S. There is frequent intelligence sharing between countries, especially those that are friendly. And there's, for example, something called the Five Eyes, which is this alliance between five countries, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and the US. And these nations share intelligence amongst themselves. Other countries do this too. For example, there are reports that Egypt warned Israel a few days before the Hamas attack on October 7th. These reports say that Egypt's intelligence chief, Abbas Kamel, warned Israel about something unusual and a terrible operation which was about to take place from the direction of Gaza. This was forwarded to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office, but the Israelis reportedly responded by saying that they were focused on preventing terrorist attacks in the West Bank. So these types of cooperations exist elsewhere too.
Interesting reporting. The World's Shirin Jafari telling us about the U.S. policy to share intelligence with others in case of an imminent threat. Thank you, Shirin.
You're welcome.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Avocados are always a precious cargo. Those things are not cheap. But Colombian police intercepted a recent shipment worth a lot more than usual. They found more than a ton and a half of cocaine hidden in avocado crates. The police posted video on social media showing agents pulling wrapped packages of coke out from under dark green avocados. The contraband was seized in the Colombian port of Santa Marta and was headed for Lisbon, Portugal.
In Japan, new evidence of the country's changing demographics. A diaper manufacturer there says it will stop making baby diapers due to slumping demand. It will increase production instead on adult diapers. The number of births in Japan dropped to a new low in 2023, with more than twice as many deaths as new babies. The Japan Times reports that OG Holdings will make its last infant diapers in September.
And Thailand is now closer to legalizing same-sex marriage. Lawmakers in the lower house of parliament overwhelmingly approved a marriage equality bill today. It's expected to pass the Senate next and get the king's approval. That sets up Thailand to be the first country in Southeast Asia to legalize gay marriage.
And that is a few things you might have missed. Flying cars, the ultimate space-age fantasy. The Jetsons family car is not confined to cartoons anymore. Today, the Slovakian company that developed the Air Car announced it has sold rights to the flying car to a Chinese firm. The Air Car has done test flights of just over half an hour. Stephen Wright knows a lot about the technology and its limits. He's an aviation expert at Tampere University in Finland. Stephen, start with what this car actually looks like.
Yeah, the vehicle itself looks rather like one of these highly aerodynamic vehicles that we used to see crossing America on these various solar-powered challenges in the 90s. So it's a really quite long wheelbase. And the reason why it looks like that, a sports car effectively that's a couple of seats, it then has wings that tuck back and move really quite far backwards so they can be stowed while you're driving around. When the thing then gets to the airfield, the idea is the wings swing out like a military aircraft. So you then have some sort of mechanically controlled fan, an electric propeller behind you. There's some sort of tail, and it uses the direct drive wheels of the vehicle to then take off and climb. It's not that radical. It effectively just means that the thing can take off on a normal runway, exactly the same as if you were going to go and buy a Cessna 172 and go flying from your local aerodrome.
So a flying car would still need an airport. I mean, what then are the advantages of this? You're basically buying a cheaper Cessna, right?
Well, the idea is that you don't need a Cessna and, let's say, a Tesla at the same time. So you're able to drive to the shops, in theory, and then park your car in a parking spot and then go and do your shopping. It would need to be light shopping, I hasten to add, because these things can only carry small amounts of mass. Then you could, in theory, if you're close to an aerodrome, you could then take off and travel a considerably long distance over the top of all the surface transport, which slows you down usually, and then land somewhere else. Once you land, you drive out of the aerodrome, and then you can drive to your final destination. That's the idea.
You know, when we think about futuristic technology, it often starts out like this, limited use, but then it can get popular, develops and matures into something more mainstream. Is that the expectation with this early version of a flying car, of this air car?
I think it's a proof of concept. You've got something that's been developed in Europe. Obviously, within Europe, the rules that are set by EASA, which is the regulator, the FAA equivalent, they're quite strict, and I suspect that they're not going to be able to take it much further in Europe in its current shape and form.
And why is that?
Because the regulations are so tight. In order to be fully certified, you have to prove and to demonstrate to the regulator that your vehicle can do this, it can do that, it can fly, it can loiter, and so on.
Where in the world would that happen?
Well, if it's going to be in China, obviously the operation is going to be certified under the Chinese authorities. If they were more sympathetic to the manufacturer and the developer, then you wouldn't have the same challenges. So depending on where you intend to use it, and we know that the Chinese market for electric vehicles is really high. They're one of the largest manufacturers of electric vehicles, road vehicles, cars. And obviously they see a niche with flying vehicles, and there's a big market for this potentially.
So with China buying this technology, flying car technology, why do you think they're trying to get so far ahead of everyone else on this?
Well, I think that, you know, China's a huge country and they're looking to lead the world in what they can do. And ultimately, I think that it's not just going to be leading by manufacturing something that you can fly as a potential driver and also a hobby pilot. What they'll be looking to try to do is to, I suspect, to tie it in with autonomous flight.
What's your desire, Stephen, in taking a ride in a flying car?
Well, if the technology's resilient and if they've got mitigating measures, for instance, you know, if you lose power or there's a problem in the control system, for instance, if it deploys a ballistic chute and brings it back down to the ground, I would consider it. If it's me flying a flying car, it's unproven, I wouldn't be so happy. I'd happily take up a Cessna.
In other words, guarantee that I will go up and land safely. Yes, I will do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to have a go if it's proven technology.
Stephen right there, he's an aviation expert and a professor at Tampere University in Finland.
For years, investors have dreamed about creating a European Las Vegas in Spain. People with money have shown up with plans to build Spanish mega resorts, promising to attract visitors and create jobs. But every time, something goes wrong. The latest proposal is called Hard Rock, yes, of Hard Rock Cafe fame, and it would create a massive complex of hotels and casinos about an hour south of Barcelona. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from the coastal city of Vilaseca.
In a small bar called Manhattan, in this small Spanish beach town, two men argue. Let them open the Hard Rock Resort right now, today, says bar owner Francisco Figueras. Like the sketch of the Big Apple skyline on his bar's windows, Figueras is dreaming big. Hard Rock will create jobs, he says. We're doing terribly these days, economically speaking. I'm totally against Hard Rock, says patron Alvaro Jimenez, paying for his mid-morning beer. It's going to make a handful of people rich off the backs of the rest of us, he says, creating miserable jobs for locals. For as long as there's been global mass tourism, so this debate has raged. The dreams of riches versus fears of exploitation. In Spain, it's happened again and again, dating back at least to the mid-80s. Beginning with Mickey, Minnie, Donald, and Goofy, Euro Disney, and the bid for Europe's largest ever theme park.
Hombre, sería fantástico.
It'd be great, these anonymous fishermen and women told Spanish national TV at the time. The only thing they've built in this area is a nuclear reactor. This little port south of Tarragona was to be ground zero for Disney abroad.
La empresa norteamericana Disney ya ha elegido a Francia como el jarro de agua.
But then the news hit. The Paris suburbs had won out. The proposed spot in Spain, investors said, was too windy. 20 years later, Spain embraced a new tourism scheme, Gran Scala. Backers pitched a vast city of leisure and this time gambling to be built in a spot with less wind and people because they'd picked an arid flatland in the middle of nowhere. If it worked in Vegas, why not there?
Impuestos se calcula que pueden haber unos 600 millones de euros en impuestos anuales.
In 2008, Gran Escala spokesman Jaime Riera told me it would generate tens of thousands of jobs and many more zeros in taxes, filling local, regional and national coffers, he said. Never mind that there was no water for filling the planned artificial lakes or for flushing all the toilets in the 70 planned hotels.
Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt.
But it turned out none of that mattered because in 2008, the Great Recession hit and Gran Scala's investors skedaddled. The only winners, a handful of local farmers who'd sold the investors their land. That same year, American casino tycoon Sheldon Adelson flew over to keep the dream alive, his project EuroVegas. But he bailed when Spain refused to bend a few rules for him, like allowing smoking in indoor spaces and guaranteeing EuroVegas for any losses if it flopped. Just a day after EuroVegas tanked, politicians in Catalonia unveiled Barcelona World. It was basically the same thing, but without the guy from Vegas. Some saw this new plan as a consolation prize. It's never broken ground. In the end, pipe dreams all, but people still come out to fight, for or against them, each time. This was a protest against Hard Rock earlier this month in Tarragona. Protest leader Eloy Redon told local TV that this was yet another project that would divert resources, especially water, and during these times of ongoing drought. Neighbors, he said, would not benefit from Hard Rock. Much of the area where Hard Rock would go is open park. It's one of the last green patches of land in this entire region. I drive over to check it out.
What you see right now are green fields with olive trees.
On the ridge in the distance is an enormous roller coaster, part of a huge amusement and water park.
You can see the cars sipping around through the spaghetti-like twists and turns. And just across the road on the other side hums a massive petrochemical plant.
The location might not float everyone's boat. Local politicians have been fighting about it, and that's led to a delay in its final approval. For the moment, this is hardly the support Hard Rock needs to break ground. If history tells Spain anything, it's that investors pumping gazillions into gigantic tourism projects want certainty. Otherwise, odds are, they'll walk away. But also,
Elysium City is a massive new development project located in the beautiful region of Extremadura, Spain.
That new ones will arrive to try once again.
Elysium City is aiming to become the new Euro Vegas.
For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, Villa Seca, Spain.
The city will offer endless opportunities for visitors to enjoy.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. In India, nearly 10% of the population lives in tribal communities, known by the umbrella term Adivasi. Many worship nature as part of a faith called Sarnaism. That is not one of India's official religions, but many in these communities say that recognition is integral to preserving their cultural identity. Reporter Sushmita Pathak reports from Jharkhand in eastern India.
A short walk from the railway station in Ranchi, the state capital of Jharkhand, you come across a unique place of worship. There is no structure here, no iconography, just a tree surrounded by a metal fence to protect it.
Which tree is this?
This is the sal tree, you know.
Right.
This is the most important tree in Sarna religion and the tribal people.
Mathura Kandir has been here many times to celebrate Sarhul, the tribal new year. Sacred groves like this dot the landscape of central and eastern India, home to a large indigenous population, the Adivasis. They don't believe in idol worship or the concept of heaven and hell. Instead, they believe that their gods reside on trees, says Anjana Singh, professor of history at Ranchi University.
They are spirit worshippers. They are ancestor worshippers. They believe in magic, they believe in spells, and they have their whole lot of structure around their religion, which makes it completely distinct.
But India's census, a mammoth exercise that shapes economic and social policy, doesn't recognize Sarnaism. It classifies citizens into six faiths: Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Sikhism, Buddhism, and Jainism. Those who don't fall under these are grouped as others, which is how many tribals have been characterized for decades. But that leaves us vulnerable, says Salkhan Murmu, tribal leader and former member of parliament.
Our people, most of them are illiterate or innocent, and with pressure, manipulation. Until we get this religious identity, our people will be forced to embrace Hindu, Christianity, etc.
In the past, foreign missionaries converted many indigenous people to Christianity. Now, India's Hindu nationalists are trying to convince tribals that they are Hindus. Leaders from the BJP, India's ruling political party, often make statements like this. Hinduism and Sarnaism are the same. We both worship nature, K.K. Gupta, a BJP leader from Jharkhand, told reporters in 2022. Some Hindu nationalists blamed Christian missionaries for creating a rift between Hindus and Sarna followers. Singh, the historian, says Hindu nationalists are trying to subsume tribals into the larger Hindu identity. It's part of an effort to project India as a Hindu nation, she says. To do so, the Hindu right wing is engaging in cultural appropriation. A lot of non-profits have also mushroomed in indigenous pockets. They conduct Hindu religious events in the name of protecting the environment or uplifting tribals, she says.
If you look at the grassroots penetration of these organizations, this is amazing, beyond imagination.
In response, tribal groups are coalescing, says Singh. They're asserting their identity louder than ever. Just look around in Jharkhand. The striped red and white flag that symbolizes tribal identity is now everywhere. You can spot the flag on people's rooftops, on fences around sacred groves, and even in traffic circles.
They have been using this flag as a cultural marker and symbolism, and is widely hailed across this middle India, and has come up as a great factor of camaraderie.
Still, many tribals do call themselves Hindus because of years of cultural assimilation, living closely with India's majority faith. But increasingly, more and more are identifying as Sarna, Singh says. On a recent rainy afternoon, I drove out to the village of Angada, an hour's drive from Ranchi city. I've come to a community center where villagers learn about things like goat rearing and drip irrigation.
Johar.
I join a group of women sitting on the floor to ask them about their faith. When one woman answers that she follows both Sarnaism and Hinduism, the others counter her at once. A heated debate ensues. How can you say that you are Adivasi and Hindu, says Pinky Devi, a petite young woman. Adivasi traditions are totally different from Hindu traditions, she says. To raise awareness about Sarnaism, activists like the former Member of Parliament, Salkhan Murmu, have been organizing protests this month across central and eastern India, demanding recognition for the Sarna faith. At least two states, including Jharkhand, have passed resolutions to recognize Sarnaism in the next census, pending approval from the federal government. And in February, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's political rival Rahul Gandhi promised to recognize the Sarna faith if his party wins this year's election.
Sarna court dena hoga.
But Murmu is not putting stock in Gandhi's words. He feels all political parties have disappointed tribals. He says Adivasis are now facing an existential threat.
Adivasis will lose their entire identity and their culture, language, habits, thoughts, and their links with the nature, etc., if they will be forced to change their religion. Adivasi ka ek narsanghar jaisa ho jata hai, genocide.
We are risking a cultural genocide, he says. He's confident that the Sarna faith will get recognition eventually. After all, Sarna followers outnumber other religions in India, such as the Jains, and their religion is recognized, he says. And if the government doesn't budge, he plans on taking his fight to the Supreme Court of India. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Jharkhand, India.
He was the piano entertainer in World War II for U.S. troops in Algeria, a great Algerian musician, a Jewish virtuoso who also developed a new style for the piano, Maurice El Medioni. We learned of his death this week. During the Second World War, he was surrounded by American soldiers who, when they frequented the bars and cafes in Iran, wanted boogie-woogie and a big band sound. Algerians wanted more local music, while Maestro Medioni himself was attracted to the Andalusian rumba from nearby Spain. Only a unique spirit like Medioni could weave together those influences. Arabic microtones, sounds of Yiddish klezmer, and a swing that never left Medioni's fingers. I produced a PBS documentary about Maurice El Medioni some years ago, a wholesome story about this man who had reestablished his life in Marseille in southern France with his wife of many years, and was still revered for his joyous approach to music and the history he lived through. Maurice El Medioni died this week at age 95.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for listening.